session number 30304.
So we're at reel 15.
Yes, we more or less had a good position from which to carry out an attack, and it was just a matter really of flying straight at it and over it, dropping the bomb at what we hoped would be the appropriate point. And because on that particular occasion we were flying from the seaward side to the landward side, it meant that we had to take evasive action very quickly for two reasons. First of all, we were at a low altitude, and there were cliffs, not very high ones, admittedly, but didn't want to take any chances. And the second reason, of course, is that by this time, and there would somewhere within the hinterland be German aircraft which should be ready to take off, or having taken off, perhaps. So it was a matter of, we hope, according to the gunner, and I don't know whether he was just, you know, being a kind about this or not, I certainly have no knowledge of whether we were lucky or not, but he said that was a good hit. As we turned away and I went tearing up as fast as I could up into the cloud again, and then set course back onto the return SA3 track.
Would you continue the patrol after an attack like that? Would you still continue on, or would you at that stage head for return to base?
There's no reason why not. That was incidental. And that was one of the reasons why you were doing the patrol, you know, to try and find something like that. The only satisfaction I got from that particular incident, and I must say again that I've placed it out of its proper position because we'd already gone to the end of the patrol, whereas in fact it would be more than likely to be on the crosswind, not the crosswind, but the cross-track leg that it actually happened. But a day later, I think it was one day, it was either one day or 2 days later, my pal Henry was on an SA patrol, came across a convoy with a similar number of ships, but that one, as described, happened to be missing. So that was the only satisfaction that I got from that particular occasion.
We were discussing, obviously, a kind of routine patrol. So what would happen as you returned from a patrol? Because you mentioned, obviously, that at that time the crew would relax maybe and get some music in. But what would happen when you landed? Would there be a debriefing or something with the intelligence officer?
Oh, yes. Well, that always happened, of course, on any operation. You reported to the control room before you left and when you returned. So, yes, we all went to be debriefed. They noted the last known position of this convoy as one of the purposes of doing the whole thing. The rest of it really was commonplace.
How long would you spend debriefing, really?
Well, on an occasion like that, when we saw nothing apart from this, and the point of the Danish coast where we were, and then there was a brief action. I mean, compared with some of the actions, it was very brief. Had we been doing a battle flight and come across something like that, probably, well, we would have attacked it in line astern or something of that kind. A longer action, which of course would take longer to be debriefed about. But it's just a matter of saying what, well, more or less what I've said now, that that's all I can remember, all I was doing. I wanted to get in and then get out. Because that's the job. There's no point in hanging about.
Can I ask you some questions about, obviously, the missions that we partly came up while we were discussing that one? When the checks were made of the aircraft, is it both the pilot and the second pilot who do the checks? Do you do it together?
Well, no, because it's the pilot's responsibility. He forms the... he signs the form 700 to say that he's satisfied with the aircraft. The navigator would be busy. He would have gone straight into the aircraft, got his charts ready, and that kind of thing. Just as the wireless operator would go and whatever he does. It was what would I say? There may have been others, of course. I may have had to wait my turn. But for the actual debriefing of our crew, it would probably take no more than a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes.
Excuse me. One of the other things is, when you're navigating, we've talked a lot about, you described navigating over the land. Could you tell me what difficulties are, or how navigating over the land differs from navigating over the sea?
One of the problems of navigating over the sea, of course, is that there are no landmarks. It goes without saying. Whereas navigating over the land in those times was blessed with landmarks that you either knew or you quickly got to know. Over the sea, you would, during wartime, when there is no universal, if I can put it that way, weather report, it is a secret. A weather report in wartime is a secret that you must try and keep, so that you had to rely on the weather report, particularly as far as wind speeds and pressure, air pressure was concerned. Because the only alternative to that was if there was a wind strong enough to create a line of waves, and seen from the air, these lines at a certain distance from each other, parallel lines, are known as wind lanes, as though there are narrow lanes along, as you would see in the countryside, with a sort of hedge of white-topped waves down each side. That gives you, if you use the Beaufort scale, which relates certain movement of trees, etc., to probable wind speeds, it's usually pretty accurate if you can bear in mind the altitude that you're flying at. Winds normally get stronger as you gain altitude, until you're out of the effect that earthbound objects such as trees, buildings, etc., even the heat from built-up areas, all those things can affect air pressure. It's really a matter of putting the guidelines like that together and coming to a conclusion about what the wind speed and direction is likely to be in view of all that you've been able to observe and so on. Over the sea, there may be landmarks that you can pick up. Obviously, coming back, let us say, from enemy coasts, it is likely that you would see a promontory such as Flamborough Head before you would see the rest of the horizon line. Obviously, you've got landmarks in that sense, and of course there are shoals of rocks. You can see down into the sea to a certain depth when you're away. You can tell whether you've got a sandy shore or ground level under the sea, or rocks, small islands, that kind of thing, particular shapes of the land. You can see at some considerable distance landmarks on land of, if they're 2,000 feet high, for instance. You can see Blackpool Tower, for instance, for virtually the whole of the way down the Solway Firth. But it is to a large extent not guesswork, but a certain application of putting together various factors, which is also different to today, of course. There were one or two radio beams about even in the early days of the war. It's well known, I think, that German bombers during the Blitz came over, at least some of the aircraft fully equipped with beams to fly along. So they were obviously helped very much by that. Over the land, if you want to take it easy coming from north to south, you're flying down England, in those days you would get on one of the railway routes. The best one really is the older LNER line, more or less the way the crow flies, down much of its direction from about York downwards, going south. Otherwise, it's largely a matter of using, if you're flying at about 2,000 feet, a nice comfortable height to see so that you can see things, you would already have marked on your map whether you're flying with a navigator or as a pilot yourself on your own. You would need to have your map with you so that and it would be marked with the track that you want to steer, with particular notice taken of the probable landmarks that you expect to pass, so that you can stay on the course you've set, taking into consideration the wind direction and speed which you set on the on your course and calculator, a course and speed calculator, And when you pass one of those landmarks, let's say it's town A, then you're looking out for the next landmark. You've been bearing in mind when you drew this track the weather conditions and the speed of the wind and where it's coming from, so that you perhaps decided on landmarks you're going to look at a distance of every 10 miles, every 20 miles, depends on the day, your altitude, the type of countryside, I mean, so that you, to a large extent, other than keeping good airmanship with you all the time, in other words, being aware of your immediate surroundings for other aircraft or any other type of interference. When you leave one landmark, you're looking for the next one. And then when that passes, you're looking for the next one. It should be, to a certain extent, pre-planned before you go.
What happens in the situation where you would lose visibility? Is there a procedure then that you could follow?
Then you have to consider a number of factors. There are so many possibilities that without setting up a sample, as it were, of where you would like to get some idea how to deal with this situation, it's a bit haphazard. So let's imagine that we are flying along, visibility gets bad, we know we have high land on our port side, and we know we haven't got high land on the starboard side. So we know also that the target or the position we need to reach for safety is about 50 miles ahead of where we are, but it's round the corner of this high land. So the immediate danger is on your port side. The immediate thought about it is that is this cloud, fog, or whatever it is, very thick? If I go up, will I be able to see the top of this high land? If I carry on this course, do I know when it would be safe to go down as low as I can to try and pick up a landmark, to find out, in fact, where I am? But I think the wise pilot would say, well, there's only one safe thing to do here, and we know that on the starboard side there is the sea. If I do have to make an emergency landing, I would rather do that in the sea than try and do it on the side of a mountain. So I would go into this mist at what I know to be a safe altitude on the starboard side, and be very careful about measuring the likely distance I would have to go, in terms of time, at the speed that I'm flying or want to fly, so that I know that I've reached the edge of the coast, and that there's nothing likely to be below me other than the sea. It's very, very rare that visibility from 50 feet denies you any sight of what's below. After all, you're looking virtually down through any mist or fog, and not horizontally or at an angle through it. So it's likely that you have a better idea than you would if you were standing up and looking at the mist on the ground, because of the different attitude that your sight line takes for you to try and see what's below. So even if it's even if the cloud is, as we say, on the deck, it's still a good idea, once you're clear, you know you're clear of the land, to get down as low as you have to in order to establish what's underneath you. From there, then you would have to, knowing that you've got to go sort of round the corner around this high land, which you had left on your port side, you have to go round it at some point safe enough beyond it to be able to get down low enough to get under the cloud and into it. So there again, it's a matter of quickly working out the likely distance against your speed and timing yourself so that you get to the appropriate point where you can start to feel for any diminution of the visibility, fog or whatever it is. And remembering, of course, that several other things are possible. For instance, if there's an area that has been marked by you, I mean marked in the sense of noted, perhaps, noted by you when you were given the navigation briefing, where the wind is likely to reach or start to blow or whatever, and this is related to the differences between high pressure and low pressure, and you've seen that on the chart, you may say, well, if I go in that direction for far enough, there's going to be a wind, however slight, it will start to move that fog or mist, and that would be a greater chance. If I don't find it on my first turn in towards my target, my goal, as it were, then I'll go a little further because the wind may have been sufficient to remove some of that fog or ice or smog or whatever. And so if you're not lucky, if you don't manage to find the position you want to go to, round the corner, as it were, on the port side after all that, and then you turn round and go out to sea, get a decent height and bail out.
Patrols in the North Sea, what kind of duration would they be for?
Duration?
How long would they take? How long would you be flying on these patrols?
Oh, I see. 4 or 5 hours. And depending on... You see, very often we would have to take over another patrol, not the one that was normally within our area. So if we start off with SA1, SA2 and so on, we were normally about SA3 or 1, I forget which one now. I've got it on a diagram somewhere. But it may be that because towards the end of this period where security area patrols were needed, Coastal Command was being pushed at both ends. We were having to supply patrols, escorts for convoys on the one hand, and also going east for these ship and a shipping role or merely reconnaissance roles. It may be that 233 squadron up at, whichever squadron, at 206 that, were very busy, didn't have the aircraft, had lost one or two aircraft, some unserviceable or whatever, and they weren't able to do their particular patrol, security area patrol. And they would ask another squadron such as ourselves to do it for them. So obviously I remember doing a patrol which started off the mouth of the Edinburgh.
The Solway Firth?
Further forth. That was the starting point. So obviously that was going up at more towards Norway rather than Denmark, and took us all that much longer. I think that was probably a seven-hour trip or something like that.
You'd arrived in the October of 1940 with the squadron. Was there a period where you flew just as a second pilot before you took over as a pilot, as a captain of the aircraft?
I don't understand quite what you mean by second pilot. I mean, I was the second pilot of two, but if I'd been actually flying the aircraft, I would have been the captain for that particular sortie.
So how did it work then? Was it that you were allocated? Did you do different? Did you take the different roles on?
We did it alternately. So if you flew today and I navigated, I would be flying tomorrow and you would be navigating.
And at that then, you would gain the experience of both roles,
yes.
Then, would you?
Yes. Mind you, I'm not sure that everybody did it the same way. I can think of one or two chaps who... But one or two of them didn't seem to be all that keen on navigation, and as they were perhaps, you may be flying with a flight lieutenant when you were a sergeant. Not that made any difference to the titular captain of the aircraft, but there is that difference in authority between you, and there were some chaps who preferred to fly as pilots much of the time. These were nobody else's business, shall I say. I was lucky in that Ainsworth, that was his name, yeah. P.L. Ainsworth was my first co-pilot. I think co-pilot's a better word. I think probably we did a couple of trips first when he was the pilot. I did the navigating. But then after that, we just took it alternately, and I think that was the usual case.